We just go?
Yeah.
Bill Alcoholic?
Bill.
What up? 6 and 7. Here's a couple of quotes that I gleaned that I kind of like about may pertain to this these steps. Dave Barry, I can win an argument on any topic against any opponent. People know this and steer clear of me at parties. Often, as a sign of their great respect, they don't even invite me. I think that fits me.
Yeah.
Stephen Hawking. I think computer viruses should count as life. I think it says something about human nature that the only form of life we have created so far is purely destructive. We've created life in our own image.
Ooh.
Dame Rose McCauley. It is a common delusion that you can make things better by talking about them.
Nah.
I think in AA there is the illusion of intimacy because we talk about heavy stuff. And it seems like we're being very honest and open, but we're just talking about ourselves again. You know, and there's a lot of talk and there's not a... It requires some action. My character defects, I think, are just glaringly obvious. It wasn't obvious to me when I got to AA, but it certainly was to everybody else around me. And the first good 8 or 9 years of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous was filled with a lot of chaos and arguments and fights and stuff. I walked around with a clipboard with a list of good people on one side and bad people on the other. And I knew that I was sent to AA to let the bad people know that they were bad because it seemed like they were walking around not being aware of it. Somebody had to draw it to their attention that they needed to change for the good of the fellowship. And it was my job to do that. And I was relatively aggressive about it. On one occasion, I was chairman of the intergroup of our central office, and I had made some joke in the meeting, and it had something to do with newcomers or something, and I made some flippant remark. And after the meeting, I went home, and I was typing up the minutes of the meeting and was sending it out to people, emailing it out, and the sign-up sheet, this woman had signed up, and I couldn't make out her name or her email address, so I called her, and she said to me, she goes, it's just remarkable that you just called me. I was just getting ready to call you. And I go, oh. She says, I really took exception to what you said today in the intergroup meeting. I think you were totally out of line, and she just ran it down to me. And I'm sitting there while she's getting on me about what I had said, trying to remember what she was talking about. I couldn't remember. Finally, I realized that she had completely misunderstood what I said. So I interrupted her, and I brought it to her attention. I said, no, I didn't say that. This is what I said. She agreed that she misunderstood me, and then she continued to berate me anyway. And I'm sitting there, and I'm just, like, completely confused. And I get off the phone, and I call my sponsor, Jay, and I said, are these people just stupid? Is that what it is? They're just stupid. They don't get it. That's, you know, I'm always reading some kind of neurotic depth into it. But maybe they're just stupid. Maybe that's what it is. And he says to me, he says, maybe someday, Bill, you'll get it. And I said, get what? And he said, it isn't what you say that pisses people off. It's how you say it. It's who you are they don't like. And it was like somebody took a big pair of shears and just jabbed me in the chest with it, you know? And I knew that what he said was true. I kind of innately knew it. And, you know, he wasn't trying to hurt me. He was just telling me the truth. And that's what I brought to AA. I mean, I'm convinced that when you and I started drinking and using, we stopped growing emotionally. We stopped growing up. And I got here at 37, you know, close to middle age, almost 40 years old. And on a good day, I had the emotional development of a 16-year-old, and this kid was not an honor student. You know, he's the one with a bit of a problem with authority. I mean, he's not mature beyond his years. I mean, he's a stunted 16-year-old that thinks he knows it all. That's what I brought to AA. Decent language skills. You know, I look like I'm grown up, I'm big and stuff, but I have tantrums. And when you anger me, I take it really deeply, profoundly, personally, and I chew on it for months. I mean, it goes on for a long time. You know, I keep track of people that I don't like. It's like, have you ever hated somebody really good, then on a given day you forget to hate them, so the following day you got to hate them extra to make up for the murder? Stuff like that. You know, stuff like that. Because I think they can feel it. I think they feel it. Now, when I say that out loud, I realize that's not true, but I behave like they feel it. Like he told me one time, he says, you know, Bill, the people you hate don't feel it. This was news to me, you know. I mean, I'm the one that feels all that anger and that rage and that turmoil. So my defects of character are real obvious. I'm arrogant. I'm pompous. I talk down to you. All this is based in a feeling of inferiority, that I've got to get up on you. I don't want to sit in the room with you. I don't want to be a sheep like everybody else. I want to be at the head of the room, being in charge. I have no desire to just be one among many. This is when I got here. And I behave that way. I'm the guy that tries to share twice in the AA meeting. You know? I'm that guy, because I got a lot to say. You know, I got a lot to say. I know a lot of stuff, you know. And, yeah, I have a big ego, but it's all based in fear. And I'm a little boy. But those things are not my biggest problem. Those character defects that you can see that are so glaring, they're so huge and so glaring, not even I can deny them. And when I do my early inventories, I could put that in that fourth column. This is my fault and mistake. I'm arrogant. I'm pushy. You know, I'm overbearing. All of that kind of stuff. You know, I'm a nitpicker. I'm too verbose. I'm too verbal. I can't listen. I don't listen well because I'm just waiting for you to stop talking so I can start again. I don't really hear you. There's no real emotional connection between you and I because I'm so profoundly self-centered. I was 3 years sober until I really realized how profoundly self-centered I was. You know, I mean, I don't know that. I've never been unself-centered, so how would I know that I've become that way? I mean, it's my normal way of feeling. I figure everybody else feels the same way. It was shocking to me to realize that not everybody is that self-obsessed as I am. There's other people that are very... One time a woman came up to me in AA, I was ranting on at the podium about all of you people that aren't doing it right. You need to get off your asses and start really doing something here. You know, you're just worthless. You're dead weight. You know, we're carrying you around. I actually said from the podium one time, I was 5 years sober and I was speaking somewhere, and a bunch of old timers sitting in front of me playing with the pencils on the tables, and I looked down at them. I said, you know, it's us guys that are 5 years sober that are running AA to give you guys somewhere to sit and do nothing. I actually said that. One guy, this is not kidding, one guy looked up at me, he couldn't believe I said it, and he looked up at me and went, whoa! And he was like impressed that I would say something that arrogant, you know? And I would, you know, that's the way I was. But those things that are so glaring are not my biggest problem. Bill Wilson said that he wrote Defects of Character and Shortcomings because he did not want to repeat himself, that there is no difference between the two. A friend of mine, sober Tommy Monin, gave me a definition of character defects and shortcomings that I really like. And he said, you know, defects of character are parts of me that don't work well, that cause me trouble. The shortcomings are parts of me that are completely missing, the parts of me that never developed, the parts of me that the psychotherapeutic community is trying to get me in touch with by going back into the past to root out the root cause of my problem. Because there's this illusion that I've stuffed these things, that there's a good guy deep down inside there just waiting to come out. My contention is, and having done a lot of psychotherapy over the years, is that what they're looking for is not there. It's never been developed. I mean, the depth of my shallowness knows no bounds. You know, there's stuff there that I never learned, that I wasn't in the room when they were handing it out. I didn't have the experiences because I was loaded. I missed a lot of stuff. Compassion. And the components of compassion, the offshoots of it, patience and tolerance. I lack those things. I've learned those things to some extent in AA as I've grown up. I've learned to have compassion. I've learned to give other people space to talk. I've had to consciously sit and make myself listen. Consciously. Look you in the eye and be quiet and listen to you speak to me and hear the words that you say. I have a friend in AA, sober longer than me, that told me a story along those lines about when his wife wants to talk to him. They go into the kitchen and sit down at the kitchen table so there's no other distraction. He takes out a pad and a pencil and takes notes while she's speaking to him, because his attitude is, why would you ever listen to a woman anyway? And he wanted to save his marriage. And he identified that in himself, that that's how he felt, right or wrong. That's how he felt. And he had to do something to change that dynamic in order to salvage his marriage. And they've been married a long time today. This was years ago. To teach him how to listen. I've had to do things like that to force myself to hear you speak to me. To really understand that I am so profoundly self-obsessed that it's virtually impossible for me to have a relationship with you. And in that state of being, I have no compassion. It was in our 11-step meeting that Jay talks about, and there was a woman there years ago that used to come there named Catherine. And Catherine was a little off. She had fried a few brain cells. Nice-looking woman, older woman, dressed kind of strangely, often, frequently. She would come to the 11-step meeting in kind of an evening ball gown, you know. She had a green one. Do you remember her?
Mean Cajun?
No. But she had this green one, and I was always intrigued by her. I thought she was very interesting, and I would speak to her and stuff. And whenever she'd share in the meeting, I'd listen to her, because she it was always a little off, about 10 or 15 degrees, you know. And it was kind of interesting, and I tried to figure out what she was talking about. One night in the meeting, I shared in the meeting when I came to realize I realized I had no compassion. I couldn't feel anything for you. When you would share in the meeting and start crying about something, I was embarrassed for you. I couldn't feel the emotion coming from you. I thought it was fake or something. And I started to talk about this to people. I went up to Lee one time and I said, you know, when people share in meetings and they cry and stuff, I just think they're faking it. And he looked at me and he goes, yeah, I wonder what they're getting away with. You know, and I walked away and I went, God, there's something wrong with me. This is emotion and I don't get it. You know, and suddenly I realized it was me, it wasn't you. You're in an AA meeting in a safe place, sharing from your heart. And I can't connect, I'm not connecting. So I shared in the meeting about having no compassion. And I said, you know, I have no compassion, and I was really upset by that. And this woman, Catherine, came to me and she said, you have compassion. I go, how do you know that? And she looked at me and smiled. She says, you have compassion for me. Chokes me up. She says, I can feel it from you. You care about me. I know you do. And I left the meeting that night and went, whoa. You see, I'm always looking for a head rush. I don't know anything else but that. And emotions, most of them are very subtle. They're quiet things. And you and I, being children of chaos, only notice emotions when shit is flying across the room. Well, he must love me. He threw the lamp at me. You know? Now I feel alive, you know, because there's stuff happening, you know. And that was me. And I realize now that was what all the conflict was about. That's what all the arguments are about, is feeling alive, trying to, you know, get that energy, that adrenaline rush, you know. I heard a guy say one time, the first time peace happened to me, I thought I was bored. You know, and that's very much my story. I said, why would you want to be peaceful? What's that about? You know? And today I seek it out, but then I didn't. And I realized when Catherine spoke to me that something was developing in me, that there was some compassion happening. Something was beginning to happen. I described to you a little bit about it, you know, about 10 years sober and everything fell apart in my life, and everything, literally. I broke up with my wife and children and ended up in the store. A lot of stuff happened. And coming out the other side of that, doing that inventory, it's somewhere in my teen years of sobriety is when I really fell in love with you. I had always felt some kind of connection, even though I wasn't listening. I was mostly, Jay told me, he says, Bill, when their eyes roll back in their head, you've gone on too long. Because I would preach at you, I would talk down to you, I did a lot of things poorly in sponsoring people. I look back on that time, though, and there was a lot of people that got help, a lot of people that have stayed sober for a long time. You know, you kind of get what you need around here. It's on-the-job training. Somewhere in my teen years is when I really fell in love with you, and I could feel the connection. You know, I began to really care about what was going on in your life. I started picking up the phone and calling you to see if you were okay. I started remembering what we talked about last week when you showed up this week, stuff like that. You became real in my life. And I've really connected with some people on, for me, a very deep level. I'm sure there's deeper levels, but I feel very close to a lot of people. With that compassion, with caring, automatically comes patience and tolerance, where I want you to get better. I want you to have this happy life. I want you to have things in your life. And I root for that, you know, and I help you do. I've always been one where there's no boundaries. You know, you do whatever you can for somebody. You know, you go get them. John Gunner told me a great story about driving some weirdo to Mobile, you know. I'll take you. You know, I mean, there's no good reason to drive that loser to Mobile, you know. Why not? Just do it. See what happens. You know, I mean, the most spiritual thing you'll hear is get in the car. So character defects, shortcomings, character defects. The way that they get addressed is you come to me. You can see what they are. You can see what they're in the fourth column of that resentment list. My faults and mistakes, there they are. You can make a list of them if you want. The little joke I tell is there are two paragraphs in the book. There's really nothing for us to do. We're powerless, right? And we'll be doing that nothing for the rest of our lives, you know? And the way I think they get presented to us, the mechanism I think that happens is we get on our knees, we ask for help, and we ask them to be relieved, and the manager sends me you. You come to me, and I will see myself through your eyes better than I'll ever flesh it out on my own. You sit in a room with a guy and you give him a 20-minute lecture on how he should live his life. Then he leaves the room and you think to yourself, that's good stuff. I should try some of that. You run headlong into your own hypocrisy. You come to understand that giving really good advice that you're not doing yourself is a lie. I think, no, it's not. I'm not lying. It's good advice. No, because you're leading people to believe. The road gets narrower. You're leading people to believe that you're doing this stuff, and you're not doing it. I'm not praying and meditating in the morning. I'm not reading anything. I'm not doing that stuff. But you really should do it. It's good advice. But I don't do it because I've transcended that. I've gone.
My sponsor does it for me.
My sponsor does it for me. You know, he tells me. He says, "I pray and meditate for you, so you don't have to build out your business." And I've got the full service. That's an extra added. You know, get Jay as a sponsor, then you don't have to do spiritual shit. He'll just tell you about it. You know. But I'm doing this, and all of that crashed and burned. It doesn't work. I'm here to report to you that does not work. People run away from those kinds of realizations. People run and hide. Some people get loaded behind it. Some people run away. They drift away from AA. They stop doing it. It's too painful to look at. We keep waiting for a place to arrive where everything's going to be like this now forever. I have yet to find that place. I don't even look for it anymore. I mean, wherever I am right now seems to be fine with me. And I know that there's going to be transitions to come because I know guys that are 30, 35, 40, 45 years sober, and they talk about those things. They talk about what happened to them when they were 35 years sober, the realization that comes to them. All of this stuff, to me, is defects of character or shortcomings. It's about us growing up emotionally. And, there's been a lot of conflict in my life. There's much less conflict in my life today. I'm not interested in it anymore. I don't get any juice out of it anymore. It doesn't work for me anymore. There's nobody on my resentment list. There's nobody in my life today that I hate. There's people that have hurt my feelings, and I understand that I'm responsible for that. There's people that I've gotten disappointed. There's friends that I was very close to that are no longer in my life or in my sphere that I feel sad about. But I don't hate anybody anymore. I don't find it necessary to change your thinking anymore or to argue with you about AA or anything, really. You know, every once in a while I try to step into the political arena and have a conversation with somebody about it, and I realize I'm still not mature enough to do that. Because it ends up with me looking at them and essentially telling them, you're stupid because you don't think like me. You know, and the first time I put my toe in that water recently, I went and I told Karen, I go, I'm out of it. I can't do this because I'm going to start name calling. I thought I was better, but I'm not. You know, I'm just not. Thank God for AA that we don't talk about those. That's why we don't talk about those things here.
Oh.
Did I start?
No, I think those are my glasses.
So anyway, that's all I have. That's 6 and 7 to me. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I've been looking for this here all morning. Thank you. It came back to
nice.
Me. Matt, the alcoholic.
Thank you.
That was great, Bill. That was great. So 6 and 7. My experience, one of my experiences with 6 and 7, I told you about doing that inventory with that sponsor who wanted me to be current if I was going to have him as a sponsor, and I had done some stuff sober and he showed me my patterns. And then he said, you know, he got out the book and said, so it says here, now that you've done a fifth step, you go be quiet for an hour and you make sure you've done everything. And he said, and then you're going to pray for God to remove these patterns, this way you live. And it was so clear. The character defects were so clear, but they were also very dear to me. They were how I lived. They were how my love life worked. They were how my financial life worked. They were how I made me feel okay about me. And they were based on false, no foundation. And he had really clearly said that. He didn't attack me. He simply said, hey, these words you told me seem to represent these patterns. So he lived in Hermosa Beach at that time. It's a nice beach community. And there was a bookstore then called Either Or Bookstore. And it had a terrace sidewalk. So they had these benches. So I walked away from his house, and I walked down to Either Or Bookstore with my character defects in my hand. And I sat there because it was around sunset time, and I loved that place. And I was just sitting there looking at the ocean, and I was afraid because I didn't know what I would be. If I'm not going to be these things, what am I going to be? You know, what am I going to be? Like, and, you know, I was a couple years sober at this time. This was my second inventory. And I got quiet, and I did what it said in the book? Had I laid a foundation? Had I left anything out? And then I did what I think was my first spiritual act in Alcoholics Anonymous, is I really prayed that if I believe that this animating force that has seemed to change when I got in the current going the right direction, my life seems to change and things are conspiring to make my life better when I decided not to rely on my own will and did these steps, I had to believe that the animating force or the higher power or God or whatever was going to make something better out of me. What I was I was throwing my crutches away. I was going to try to walk without my crutches. And so I prayed that they'd be removed. And I just wanted to mention that because I really felt like it was my first real surrender. It's a spiritual surrender. I surrendered all along. I didn't drink. I surrendered the bottle. I surrendered my character defect. I surrendered my stuff on my fifth step. I surrendered to AA a lot. But this was my first inner surrender where, look, if I'm not going to be these things, I trust it's going to be okay. The other thing I wanted to say is that my favorite part of the literature is in the seventh step and the 12 and 12. There's actually poetry in there if you read it. There's one line I love is, where humility had formerly stood for a forced feeding on humble pie, and now begins to mean the nourishing ingredient which gave us serenity. Where humility had formerly stood for a forced feeding on humble pie, it now begins to mean the nourishing ingredient which gave us serenity. So why would I be humble? Why would I humbly ask God to remove my character defects? Because I want serenity, right? So the last page of that 12 and 12, that 7-step and 12 and 12 has these great lines. Is, the chief activator of our character defects is self-centered fear, primarily fear that we would lose something we already possessed or would fail to get something we demanded. So the activator of my character defects is fear. And the reason I love these quotes is because sometimes, how many people have had this experience where you read this book and you read this literature and you're like, God, Bill Wilson's reading my mail. You know, my character, so the way I can describe this in my life is I'll be driving home from work, and sometimes that's a long way because I actually live in another town sometimes while I work, and I'll be thinking, you know, man, I don't make enough. I can't wait to get home and see my wife. I miss my wife desperately. I love being in the house with her. I love holding her in my arms. I miss my children. And I'll be driving home, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if I'm making enough money because we got this, and then this college for feeding, you know, and I start to get a little bit afraid. You know, uh-oh. And then things pile up, a lot of that stuff. It's like, oh, I've been gone a little while, and my son's acting out a little bit, and I start to feel a little guilty. I've been gone too much, you know. And I walk in my door, and these people that I missed and that I loved are suddenly, I'm yelling at them. I'm pissed. The house isn't clean enough. And those kids are not, what's wrong? They were supposed to do this. And don't jump all over me right now. I just came through the door. And all I could do, all I wanted to do was be with them. All I wanted to do. But the activator of my character defects was my fears. I got up into my head and started thinking I was not enough. And I came through the door and I lashed out at the people that I loved. And I didn't want to do that. It's not like the choice we make due to fear is to do lame things. It is the activator of my character defects. It's the ingredient that makes them bloom. So I don't want those character defects anymore. I want them to go away, you know. And what I found from being once a Catholic, always a Catholic. I don't know what the mix is in here, but I don't like Catholic churches. I don't profess to be a Catholic, but it's kind of like, you know, being Jewish. It's who you are. And I'm not a Jew. I'm Jewish. I'm Catholic, you know. It's like a brand. And so, yeah, Lucky Brand Jeans and Catholic Matthew. And what I found being Catholic is I've worked on myself and worked on my sins and worked on being better until I realized that's a completely futile exercise. It has no effect on them. All it does is make them grow.
Yeah.
You start saying, I'm going to be less judgmental. The next thing you know, all you're doing is judging everything. So I had a, somebody gave me a book when I was in rehab, and I highlighted this, this phrase, and I thought it was so beautiful. It says, trying to change our character through force of will is like trying to fly by repeatedly jumping into the air. You will have exactly the same effect. And so what I've found is that there's a phrase that Scott Redmond and Bill use sometimes, to keep things above the horizon line. Be aware of what my character defects are, and be willing to be that thing that I don't know is going to be if I let go of them. You know, another quote I like from James Arthur Ray, I use when I lead these retreats myself, is control is never achieved when sought after directly. It's kind of like the theme of the morning. It is the surprising outcome of letting go. So that's the trick with character defects in 6 and 7 for me, is that 7 says we humbly asked him to remove them. So that my job is the humility part. And you know what humility looks like in daily action is when I'm driving home and I start to think I don't make enough money, I stop and say, hey, wait, I'm not in charge. Am I doing the next indicated thing? I am. I'm going to work. And I can leave that conversation out of my head. And when I walk through the door and my wife turns and smiles at me, all I see is that smile. I don't project my fear onto her and start berating her. And when my children are talking, I don't come out of a thinking blackout, because I'm not thinking. They're talking and I'm right there with them. And you know what? Very often, they're telling me exactly what I need to hear. You know, I was driving the other day with my daughter, Sophie. She's 10 years old. And I was looking out the windshield and she said, hey, Dad, you okay? 10 years old, my little therapist. And I said, yeah, I'm okay. And I said, it's just hazy. It's overcast. I hate it when it's overcast. It just makes me bummed out. And I said, you know, and I wanted to do a bunch of stuff today, and I don't think I'm getting much of it done. And she goes, man, it's the Great Depression all over again. So am I going to listen to Yoda, or am I going to be in my head? You know, like, I heard her. It's ridiculous. It's overcast. Poor you, you know. You know, and she just put it, you know, whisked it away, put it in perspective. And, you know, and see, being present with my children, my son's 13, and it's hard on him. He's having a hard time. He's pissed, and he doesn't know why. He's told me, I don't like you very much. Why? I don't know. You know, you control me. Well, what do you want me to do differently? I don't know. You know, he's just hard. It's hard for him. He's having a hard time.
Have him call me.
And yeah, last, I don't want either of these guys getting near my 13-year-old. But but the point is it, no, what's the problem here? Read Alan Watts' book. But the thing
Burn
is,
it down.
It's okay. It's easy to see what he's going through if I'm not up here. It's so plain that he's afraid. He's full of hormones. He's supposed to be that way. He's perfect. But if I come in the door thinking I'm not a good dad and I've been missing and that's why he's having problems because I'm away too much and my wife is disabled and poor me and I can't pay the bills, then he's going to get no listening, just my loud head unleashing on him. So my job is to stay in a state of humility, meaning this, I am a piece of a whole. I am a small piece of a larger thing who has been given wonderful work. I get to do the next indicated thing, and the next indicated thing is beautiful. It's not always, you know, an alarm clock and a dirty diaper and a bill to pay. The next indicated thing for me one day was walking across the lawn and marrying the woman of my dreams. The next indicated thing for me once I wasn't there, was to see my children be born. The next indicated thing was to be there with my parents, both when they died. I watched my parents die. That's a privilege. You know, so if I can stay out of here in the fear, the chief activator of my character defects is my thinking. If I can stay out of there and be humble, humility is the only, if you read the 7th step, it's all about humility. It says, look, you have no power over these character defects. You just have them. Like my eyes are green. I can work on my eyes being blue all day long. They don't change color. They just don't. So I have to stay in that state, and I'll tell you, this is just, this is, see, to me, the human condition. There's a guy I really like to read, Anthony DeMello, who was a Jesuit priest, and I love Jesuit priests because they kind of screw up the whole Catholic Church because they think outside the box. And he was finally, no one in the Catholic Church wanted to have anything to do with him, and he was a Jesuit priest. But he says, this is the human condition. He says, we're driving through this amazing lush valley, and we're in this huge touring bus, and there are floor-to-ceiling windows, and there's wild animals, and there's waterfalls, and there's these exotic plants, and there's exotic birds everywhere, and we've slammed down the shades, and we're fighting over our seats. Because I'm up here. I'm in a thinking blackout. And if I just get the humility that all these other steps we talked about today are designed to bring about, admit it, I'm powerless. There's something greater than me. Turn my will over to that thing. That's a humble act. Tell somebody all my stuff. Like, write it down, then tell somebody. And then get to a place where it's so clear to me that I'm powerless and I have character defects. So what is my choice? Humbly ask the power to redirect the course of my life so that I can pull the shade back up and sit down in whatever chair I've got and see the valley.
One of the difficulties about doing this thing is that I get to hang out with some people that are some of the most remarkable members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I know. And I know a lot of people in AA. I've been involved a long, long time. And it's always interesting to hear their description of themselves when I've been intimately involved in their lives for a long time, and how deeply warped their perception about themselves is. And it's just amazing. You know, I mean like when I think about 1988 Bill Cleveland, you know, I mean, there was a lot going on. And the chaos was so small compared to the generosity that he and his family showed. I mean, when you know, remodeled the house and barbecues and the parties you used to have over there, and just, you know, how you really, you know, the community that you created. And you know, I watched Matthew go through some. I probably have a better sense of what Matthew goes through than many people. And you know, it's just a real privilege to know who they are, and to be able to remind them. And you know, one of the things that I'm going to work on for the next few years is in my history work is liberating. We always talk about Bill Wilson as being the promoter, and that was a phase of his life, very short. But mostly when we talk about Bill Wilson, we're talking about a guy that was 3 to 5 years sober, maybe 7 years sober, not the man who, you know, put together the traditions, the General Service Conference, and wrote the 12 Concepts of World Service. Amazing philosophical work. Created a service structure not based on spiritual power, not hierarchy. And so, you know, we can get all hung up in this. I like Matthew's thing of his Catholicism, and Bill, we don't have a religion to blame it on, but we can come up with something. Deism or something. He was but
egocentric.
Yeah. But anyway, we have a friend, and his name's Don Coyes, and Don has been sober for many years, and he's a wonderful resource. And Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the resources is that he's Native American, and so he's not burdened by many of the by some of the consciousness that we carry. And I really want, you know, between 8 and 12, something awful is going to happen to you. Be careful. Be afraid. That's everybody.
Be ready.
Be ready. Bygones. And what our friend Mr. Coyas taught us is probably one of the most consoling things that I've ever heard in my life. And I think for step 6 and 7, it's absolute perfection. He says that in the Native tradition, there is only one number, and it's 4. And it's for the 4 seasons. Okay? And there's spring, and there's summer, and there's fall, and there's winter. And you got to have winter in order to have a new spring. And we get wrapped up in this idea of who I am or how my life should work or how I should be loved or who I should be loving or all this stuff. Or, you know, one day they're acting properly and the next day they're not. And then, you know, it's winter. And then all of a sudden there's a whole new aspect of love in my life. There's a whole new understanding that I have. There's a whole new part of me that's available that never was there before. And so when we take a look at steps 6 and 7, I mean, I think that in the beginning, you know, I mean, 6 and 7 were designed to address problems other than alcohol. Okay? I got to plug in the jug. Now, I'm still, it's like I sponsored this guy and he had a flexible sobriety date. You ever sponsored anybody with a flexible sobriety date? And this guy was amazing. He was another guy who was inflicted with Catholicism, and he was it's even worse. He's second generation Irish. This guy was first. Parents just off the boat, and just wonderful people. Anyway, his mother at one point called him the devil of all liars.
He was, too. He was awful.
Meditate upon that, you know, how you can get your mother to actually describe you in that fashion. Anyway, so he comes to me, and he's really, it seems like this go-round, he's really not drinking. And he's going off on a business trip down to Australia. And he stops by to visit me, and he's talking to me about, okay, like, how am I going to do this? I mean, he's the guy that would, on the transcontinental flight, would, instead of buying Nicorette gum, would like unhook
the smoke alarm.
I mean, he's just bizarre. Anyway, so he comes and he's talking to me, and I'm at my job, and I look at him and I say, okay, I know that when you're going to be away from your family. He was kind of estranged from his wife. You know, that when you have a flexible sobriety date, that kind of happens. So I looked at him and I said, look, when you call up for the professional to be sent to your hotel room and you tell him how you want her dressed, and I'm sure it's going to be in a Catholic girl uniform, I said, you don't have to snort cocaine off her thigh. And he looked at me. Like, how did I know? And it was just one of those moments of, you know, inspiration.
Yeah.
And you know what? The guy never drank again. There's a hierarchy of needs, okay? We're in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we get the plug in the jug, okay? But over the time, there are going to be many, many things that present themselves in our lives. And the longer I'm sober, it appears that more and more it's about not that. I will pick something up and it will give me a temporary comfort instead of going to the spiritual solution. And so it may be food. It may be money. It may be sex. It may be any of these, you know, as it talks about in the 12 and 12, any of the 12 deadlies. It seems that part of this human condition is experiencing that. Do not be discouraged. Do not be afraid. These are all things that can be addressed. And it does not have to be a veil of tears. If one has the humility to say honestly to someone, you know, I spent 36 hours on the computer watching pornography. Do you think I might have a problem?
Are you dehydrated?
Yes. Gatorade, first Gatorade. But you know, it's that where the gateway of freedom is. So in dealing with 6 and 7, I really want to just you know that since our problems are of our own making, at least that's what I've found, that having the humility to be honest about them with someone that can hold a confidence is a great thing. I've got 5 guys in my life that live in different time zones that are all sober a number of years. Some of them more than me. No, none of them more than me. But all of them. People that I consider peers. And they're the people that I call and tell the difficult truth to. And we walk ourselves through these difficult parts of our lives. And it allows us to work in dignity and grace. But that's what I think that's what the 6th and 7th step is about. My fabulous wife, who would be happy to give you a tutorial on all of my character defects. And when we do couples retreats, it's hilarious because, you know, it's just we break it down, and it's she's got worksheets that she's created to make sure that I'm able to spot it immediately. You know, it's just great stuff. But she says, you know, you don't have to. She calls them effects of character. She says that they're the effects of the character that I have that I have not got in. And she also says, you never have to worry about character defects, about figuring them out. She said, don't drink. They'll get in contact with you. She's a brilliant woman.
Answer questions.
No, I'm not done yet.
Okay, you look like you were moving along.
These were on 6 and 7, so instead of insight, okay. I thought I'd maybe
We defer to you at all times.
God, doesn't that sound wonderful? You know, that's the thing I miss about dating. People pretending, you know, saying things to me with conviction that are really just a lie.
It's a character defect of mine.
Okay, what actions can I do for steps 6 and 7? I think I just covered that. Be honest. Aren't we powerless over our defects of character? I think Matthew did a masterful job on that one. And then this one I couldn't read, so I'm going to have to do it. I crave negative attention. Really?
I didn't write that.
I enjoy riotous music, movies, and crazy friends. I'm only here because in AA, my drug and drinking abuse. I can't seem to get what I want through the use of my defects, but am obsessed with making it happen the wrong way. How do I get over this and force myself to eliminate these defects? I don't think that forcing is going to happen. The great thing for me about this spiritual movement that I'm part of, this Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I don't walk up to people and say, you need to shape up. That we all get the dignity of our own mistakes and our own spiritual path. And our friend Lee has an awful rejoinder. How's that working for you? Right. You know, how's that working for you? And so, you know, you run up against this stuff as long as you can, and then finally you're going to go, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to try something different. Now, unfortunately, I hate to tell this to you, but what it is that you're going to try different probably is the thing that your sponsor has been suggesting for the past 2.5 years. Every life form that you've slept with in the past 6 months has been, maybe you might want to, every one of us has the opportunity to live in paradise right now, at this instant. Every woman and man in here has been called forth from the dead. And we can pretend that, oh, it's I'm just doing this because, or, but we've all been lifted from the, I mean, completely like when Bill talks about Ebby, lifted out of the scrap heap to a life beyond anything that we knew. Okay? And so we can either take that and run with it, or at least encourage each other to enjoy it, or what we can do is gossip, and we've all got, you know, like I've got, my home group is a wonderful group. And we got about 100 guys, and of the 100, there's 30 of them that are under 25 years old, really under 20. And, you know, they're, most of them are in a recovery home, and they're really doing a good job. You know, I mean, they're amazing. They're amazing. Just to be able to stand and kind of warm myself by that fire is remarkable. And then we've got about a half dozen guys that run with the crowd that just don't do the stuff. And their lives continue to devolve. And I've just taken it upon myself now to walk up to him every 3 or 4 weeks and look him in the eye and say, you know, you don't have to suffer like this anymore. You know, they've got the great sponsor. They've got the wonderful friends. You know, but just to tell him, you know, you don't have to suffer like that anymore. You don't have to put yourself through that. I mean, it's entertaining. We kind of enjoy it. We'd really prefer that you used a condom because, it, you know, we're just not into the breeding thing. But, because it really is tragic when, you know, yeah, when they get that self-centered and that selfish. And that's both of the kids, not just the guys. But this step 6 and 7 also is about our home group. You know, I know you guys are the Big Easy. You know, like, okay, now what is it about my home group that I can do to help lift the consciousness of it, to help it so that it's a safer place to be in? One of the things about our 11-step group, man, is it's got the finest women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. In it.
Attraction rather than promotion.
You know, I mean, it is. Man. I mean,
I get goosebumps. Lot of levels.
I get goosebumps all over me thinking about, you know, and it's wild because, you know, I've transcended that. You know, now it's like, God, I hope one of the guys that my their grand sponsor gets to know her.
Definitely.
But they're wonderful, and we've created an environment there that young women can come in and be safe. And when the guys that are predators come in, we know who they are. And if they've got them, if they're talking to a young lady over there in the corner, we'll let them go for a little while. But one of us at some point will walk over and just kind of say hi.
Insert ourselves.
How are you?
The women
nice
do
to see
it too.
It. Oh yeah, yeah, the women do it too. And
it's a safe place.
It's a safe place.
And you know, and we'll whip them to Karen or Adele or you know, I mean, we'll get them to the gal. But I mean, this is, it's something that we talk about at our stag meeting because a lot of our stag guys go to that group. But I mean, these are the things that we can do about using steps 6 and 7 within the framework of our home group. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to be conscious of and to support, because this way of life is so exciting and it's so enjoyable. And whoever it is that wrote this thing about themselves, you know, all that we want for you is not for you to go along with some set of morals or somehow conform. All we want for you is to have a life beyond your wildest dreams. And like Matthew mentioned and Bill mentioned, you know, it's the limited perception of our mind of who we are and what's available to us. One of the great things is being able to know who these guys really are, not what it is they're thinking about themselves. So, thank you.
So, I want to take this question too, because if I were sponsoring you, and you said, I crave negative attention, I enjoy violent music and movies and crazy friends, I'm only here in AA because of drugs and drinking abuses, I can't seem to get what I want through use of my defects, but I'm obsessed with making it happen the wrong way, I would say, wow, you seem to have come a long way in your self-awareness. This is great news. The thing that's, when it says, how do I get over this and force myself to eliminate these defects, is what Jay said. Well, how is all this working out for you? It's clearly not working out for you because you're writing this. So the motivating factor is your discomfort and your dissatisfaction with your own life. And you have two choices always here. You can go further down the path or you can drink. And I think however far down the path you get, the drinking seems less inviting. And so the discomfort is the motivator. That quote I gave from Cliff Roach, you know, if drinking doesn't make you want to work the steps, sobriety sure will. That's what this is about. Is you seem to have come to the conclusion that you crave negative attention. That's a huge self-awareness. You know, most people don't brag about that. Hey, I crave negative attention. So you learned that. I indulge in a certain kind of entertainment that keeps me agitated all the time. I'm only here because of my drinking, but I have all these other issues. So what we'd say is what Jay said and what Bill and Jay have done for me is it's very clearly laid out. I just read you some poetry that was written in the 40s about your issue. We have a room full of people with experience with your issue. Your issue isn't all these things. Your issue is the simple fact that you have your effects of your character, and there's a humble way to reach to something bigger than you. You will never, ever be able to force yourself to eliminate these defects. That's a delusion. But you may find yourself in a position where letting go of these other things becomes easier and easier and easier, because a natural humility, which is the nourishing ingredient that leads to serenity, it's not a force feeding on humble pie, a natural humility starts to pervade you because you start to trust, you start to expand, you start to really turn your will in your life, you start to shut the head off on the drive home from work so you can walk through the door a fresh person. And these things will fall away. You can't force them away. But you've done six. You know, you become aware of them. That's all I have.
And the awareness, once you're aware, once I'm aware of what the problem is,
yeah.
It is the beginning of the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It has an end date now.
Because
now I know. Now I know. And every time I do whatever that is, I walk into it consciously. And because I'm of the school that there is a time in all of this where I simply could not see it. I didn't know what the truth was. I couldn't see it. It's my own, the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one because it's the only one I've ever known. And I absolutely believe that because I feel the way I do, I figure you feel the same way. The thief thinks everyone else is a thief. That's his reality. He'd steal from you. He figures you're going to steal from him. And this egoic mind, all it does, it's flat and two-dimensional. It's not trying to kill us. We say the head is out. My head is out to get me. Why would it kill the host? You know? I mean, it's not trying to kill me. It's trying to help. It's just stupid. All it does is take the past and project it into the future. It just repeats the same old crap over and over. The same fears, the same prejudices, everything's the same. And when I become aware of that, and because it's not my thinking mind that has the awareness, it's something else. This is, we'll talk about this later, but there's something else that is becoming aware that is not, I am not my thinking mind. And once I can see what it's doing, it's the beginning of the end of it. Now, it's going to fight its position. There will be an internal struggle. You know, I'm going to head for that computer to turn on the pornography. And it's going to say, oh, man, don't do it. You don't really want to do this. You know, you're withholding yourself from your wife. You didn't, you know. Well, no, I think I'm going to do it. You know? No, you really don't want to. No, just a little bit. Then I get over there. No. And it goes like that, you know. I mean, it goes like that. You know, I mean, and whatever your little hook is, whatever it is that you're hooked into that brings you that immediate gratification, you know, the short-term gain for the long-term pain. Because when I'm done with it, then I don't feel good about myself. Because I know now. So this awareness, what you've written down, whoever wrote this down, it's the end of it. It's over, dude. Now you're just going to do the dance of death. Because now you can see it.
Thank you.
Questions?
I think we're
oh, right.
3 o'clock. It's a pool. Oh, excuse me. We're going to...
Would you like the party planner?
Ha 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 ha!